Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, lots of authors around here in Chapel Hill, Carrboro, and Hillsboro. And you know that once you've, and you're probably one too if you're listening, once you've written your book, how do you talk about it to sell it, to secure an agent, to get anybody interested in it, to find a publisher, to work on maybe self-publishing it and then trying to persuade potential readers to read it, booksellers to stock it? Well, Linda Rohrbaugh, who is herself a successful author and editor and speaker and consultant, is leading a workshop at the April 12th, 2014 Spring Conference of the Writers Network, and her topic is how to make an elevator pitch. And she's come to – I'm going to get a little preview of the Writers Network Spring Conference workshop. Linda, thanks for coming.
Well, thanks for having me here, DJ.
I think of a elevator speech in the context of a young entrepreneur who is trying to sell his business plan to somebody in an elevator that he or she happens to meet. How does that apply to authors?
It absolutely does apply. The interesting thing about an elevator pitch is you really have to have one for anything you're doing. Frankly, it's a good idea to have an elevator pitch if you're an engineer and you have a project and you get in the elevator with the supervisor who might be able to. And you need something short and you need something specific and you need something but long enough that you can engage somebody. For an author, though, it's a completely different set of skills than writing a book. So that's where my come in.
Give me some illustrations of most of us have heard of elevator speeches and maybe even have an idea about the concept of it. Have you got some examples you can share with us?
Oh, I have lots of examples. But let me back up a little bit, back up the truck a little bit, and let's talk about what an elevator pitch is.
Okay.
Okay, so what I think is a real disservice to the community in general, but especially the writing community, is that an elevator pitch has been touted as a one sentence, what we used to call in the writing business when I used to be a journalist, a slug. One line about the book. One line is not enough, unfortunately. And one line is good, certainly it's a start, but you've got to get in a position where you can start a conversation or a dialogue or connect with someone around the book. And one line is just not enough. So you'll hear people say, well, you need to have a one-liner. You do. That's true. But I came up with, I hang out with New York Times bestselling authors, and I listen to them. We'll go shopping. I hang with Debbie Maycomber and Jody Thomas and some of my good friends. And of course, they've introduced me to other authors. We'll go shopping together. We go mess around together. We'll be at several places for a conference and we'll jump on the public transportation and go to the mall. You know, it's a favorite thing to do. And while we're doing that, I hear them talk to people they don't know about their books. So I was listening carefully.
Great. Oh, this is good.
Well, this is how it happens, right? I mean, these guys are the cream. They know how to do this. They're professionals. They've worked at it until it's second nature to them. So I listen. Nobody at that level has one sentence about their book. Nobody does. They have two or three sentences that start to engage the reader about the book. And what's interesting, Debbie is so famous, and she's number one New York Times bestseller.
All right, just tell us about Debbie, because most of us probably don't know who Debbie is.
Debbie Maycomber, number one New York Times seller in women's fiction. Nora Roberts is number one in women's romantic fiction. Debbie is number two. So, and Debbie is wonderful, but she reminds me of somebody's godmother. You know, she has that kind of look to her, and so we'll get in a store. And authors, unfortunately, are not always recognized. And so, and that's a good and bad thing, right? So we're in a store, we're talking to a clerk, and I have a great story about Debbie and I were in Chico's in Seattle. So we had decided, she actually had the house valet parked because it would be easier and she didn't want to walk as far. And so we go to Chico's together. And she and I are in the store, and there's a line of dressing rooms. And so they put me in what they call the Princess Di dressing room. And it's got a big mirror, and I can see. You know, and then they stick Debbie down by the manager's office. And
they don't know who she is.
No idea. And I told her, I said, do you want to switch? Well, she's not that kind of gal. So she said, no. This is a great story because we made a pact, okay, like women do when they shop. And the pact was that whatever we were wearing, we would show it to the other one without taking it off first. Because sometimes, you know, you get in the mirror and you go, oh my gosh. But the deal was, we'd come out. So I come out to show her, and the manager walks by and she says, do you read romance novels, to Debbie? And I'm going, well, this ought to be good, right? And so I kind of fold my arms and wait, you know, and Debbie goes, yeah, I do. And she goes, do you read Debbie Maycomber? And she goes, I am Debbie Maycomber. Oh my gosh. The whole store just went vibrating. And it was so interesting to watch how everybody responded to her. And so then I got an opportunity to watch her talk about her work to these people. Of course, the first thing they did was yank me out of the Princess Di dressing room. That was over. And we both got a 30% discount in addition to our regular Chico's discount. And they forgot all about me. And they were totally focused on Debbie. But at one point, Debbie put on this outfit and it had this jacket and had a ruffle around the bottom. And she came out with it on and she said, what do you think? And I said, oh, Debbie, that looks terrible. Promise me you're not going to buy that. And she said, well, they said it looked good. And I said, but they know who you are now. Now that you could come out with a burlap sack on and they'd say it looks great because they know it's you. So it's interesting when you've made it as an author, of course, then it's a different deal.
Yeah, I guess you learn from the best-selling authors some of their techniques, but the people who really need the elevator pitches are not number one bestsellers, authors, but those who aspire just to get published or to get a bookstore owner enthusiastic about his or her work. But now, you did say you learned from
them. I did. These,
and what did you learn from them?
I came up with a 3-step formula that works for any book, but it's especially good for fiction. So we start with that regular logline, and you can go out on the internet and look up logline, and you'll find a formula for a logline. And that's a great
start. What's
the
difference between a logline and an elevator pitch?
Well, the elevator pitch is more than just the logline. You've got to engage your listener.
So you get the logline first?
Get the logline first.
That's what you. That's your hook, and then you have a minute or.
That's your hook. And I actually have not only, I help the writers develop 3 sentences about their book, okay? And then I teach them how to deliver those 3 sentences so that you engage the other person. Because the bottom line is, when you're an author, you want to develop, first of all, the first person you're working with is an agent or an editor. But after that, it'll be readers. But once you sell the book to an agent or an editor, very few authors ever change their pitch for the book after.
Well, give us an example first of a logline.
Logline is, let's take something everybody's seen, the movie Rocky, okay? Rocky is, so we've got the hero, that's the first part. So the hero is a boxer with low self-esteem, okay? So we've got a boxer with low self-esteem gets a chance to fight for the heavyweight title. That's a logline. It's real simple. I actually have a 5-step formula that's, and some of them are implied and some are stated, but you want me to go ahead and give you the formula for Okay. The formula for the first line is this: hero, flaw, life-changing event, opponent, ally, battle. So we've got 6 components.
Try to get all that in one sentence.
One sentence. And now some of it's implied. Let's go back to our logline for Rocky, okay? So we've got a boxer with low self-esteem, all right? So we've got our hero and we know his flaw right off the bat. Now, notice that we're doing what you're taught in fiction not to do, right? We're using cliches. We're using stereotypes. You break all the rules when you do the logline, which is part of the reason it's so confusing for writers. Because they would never write like
this. This is cheap stuff for them. They think this is not literary fiction.
It's TV Guide, which is actually, I tell writers, go pick up a copy of TV Guide and look at it, because you're going to find this exact formula every time. So you've got the hero, the flaw, the life-changing event is he gets an opportunity to fight for the title. Okay? The opponent is himself, clearly. Right, and then what he has to do to get ready for the title. The ally is himself, and the battle is getting ready for the fight. So some of those things are implied, but they're all present. Notice they're all present.
I tell you what, and I need to take a break. I hate to break in the middle of this. We're going to come back and we're going to go right back to the log line and then talk about the rest of what this elevator pitch that you're teaching these great authors how to also be great salesmen. Linda Robarn, I'll be right back.
Check out our comprehensive community calendar, photo galleries, and all of our news stories and more from 97.9 FM WCHL on chapelboro.com.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Linda Rohrbaugh, and we are talking about, we're really talking about this, Linda, in terms of the upcoming spring conference for the North Carolina Writers Network. It's going to be in Greensboro on April the 12th.
Yes, sir.
And you're going to do a workshop, and you've already taught us so much.
I'm excited to teach it.
If you joined us late, Linda's sort of teaching us as if we were a writer of a book that is good, but that we can't get attention for, and how to compact our spiel, our pitch about our book that's honest, but is also something that will get the attention of people who need to get attention to it. You start out your pitch with a log line. That's all new to me. And you want to review real quickly the elements
sure.
of that log line?
So we've got three sentences to pitch a book. And we can use this for nonfiction as well. And I'll teach you how to do that when we get a second. But fiction is the hardest, so we'll start there. The six elements for the first sentence are hero, flaw, life-changing event, opponent, ally, and battle. It's really kind of plug and chug when you think about
it. It's kind of what?
Plug and chug, is what I love about it.
You plug
this.
In that little, you've got to put something in each one of those
You put something in each one of those. And then you decide, then you're arranging that sentence. Well, you're a writer, you should be able to arrange it. And some of those things can be implied, but they all should be present.
Well, this is real interesting, Linda. And during the break, we talked about the main rule for an interview is not to interrupt his guest.
That's okay.
But I mean,
we get excited.
I'm excited. And I'm thinking about that. Yeah, I like that. I can work that. Give me the chart. And tell me what needs to be in it. So do you give your authors a little chart with six spaces? And say,
I do. It's part of the handout. I actually work with learning styles. So when I do a workshop, I want nobody, and I've never had this, I don't want anybody leaving my workshop saying, I don't understand how to do this. Mm-hmm. Everybody leaves with a pitch.
So to get towards the pitch, you start out with a rudimentary, all right, look. It's like a crossword puzzle. I've got six blanks.
Right.
You fill in the answers to these questions, and then we'll work with that information to massage it so that it works as a great.
Exactly.
I love this.
Exactly. But now, and of course, the trick is get out of your head that everything has to be original and that it has to be fresh. Now you use cliches and you use metaphors and you use. Stuff that has social nuance and all that, it's okay. And that's what is so confusing. So you take that first sentence and you're tweaking it. And now when I talk about learning styles, I've got it in the handout, six blanks, right? I've got somebody writing that on a whiteboard. I've got it on the overhead projector. I'm saying it, right? And then I'm giving examples. Nobody leaves. I remember somebody was doing the writing up on the whiteboard for me. He said, took me aside and said, why am I writing on the whiteboard when, and I said, look, because somebody is going to remember you writing that up there when they don't remember anything else. And so we work with those learning styles when we're doing the workshop. So people come in. It doesn't matter what your learning style is. I'm going to hit you somewhere. And some people have combinational learning styles. So they'll remember writing it in the handout and seeing it on the overhead or
What I mean? Well, I want you to. I'm loving this. I think that the folks who are listening to us might be having a little bit of trouble understanding where you get to. So, take us through the exercise again, with a different subject other than Rocky, of filling out the chart with six elements.
Okay.
And then translating that into, now this would be your first sentence of your three. Is that right? This would be
yes, this is the first of the three.
So go through that.
Well, the hero, obviously, is usually the protagonist in the story. And it's not always the person who changes. I love to use, there's a very old movie called...
Now, Linda, you didn't put change as one of your blocks.
Change is in the second one.
In the second. Okay. All right. We need to get through the first sentence.
Right. We're going to get there.
All right. Get me through the first sentence, then we'll go to the second sentence.
Okay. So, but we've got somebody a story. Well, you see, what I have to do partly is I have to sit down and teach you about the basic fundamentals of story. Always in a story, no matter what, somebody's
changing.
Well,
this is not fair because we've been talking about Great Gatsby.
Okay.
This is not fair. Let's try to construct the first, log.
So who's the hero in Great Gatsby? Who's our protagonist in Great Gatsby?
Well, that's great. And there would be two or maybe even more correct
Daisy,
answers.
Because right? There's Daisy, right? There's Gatsby himself. Gatsby. There's Daisy.
And the narrator. The narrator is the one whose life has really changed. So here I am. The writer who's saying, "I don't know how to do this because
and
you got to help me. And you just say, pick one."
Pick one. You can't do it that way. And who you pick changes the story. Now, if you're trying to pick one for an existing story, then you have to. I'll kind of go through all the elements. You see what I mean? So I give a bunch of examples. I go through the elements and I take things. Sometimes I'll take some movie that just came out that everybody went to see. You know, but I'll. The person who's changing is the person we want to focus on. That is not always, though, the hero. And so you got to pick. And as the writer, it's kind of your job to pick who the hero is. But obviously in Rocky's the one who changes in the story, right? So that's why we pick him. And we don't say Rocky. I rarely, rarely, rarely ever have an author put the name of the character in there. There are exceptions. For example, Lemony Snicket, right? Right. Is that, am I saying it right? That needs to go in there. Okay.
You got a weird name, put it in there. If not,
if
just say.
It adds to the, yeah. But otherwise, you're picking a cliche for this, a descriptive cliche for this person.
I'm the author. I'm Scott Fitzgerald. I got a new book. I don't know what to call it, but maybe something like Gatsby. It's about Gatsby. It's something. And so you say, okay, DG, who's your hero?
Okay, so who changes in the story, DG?
The narrator changes.
The narrator changes. So is it about the narrator observing the characters?
It is.
Okay, so what change does the narrator make?
His whole attitude about the world changes.
So what's the narrator's flaw when he enters the story?
He's young, naive, and worships the elite, the so-called elite.
So a naive, what's a male? He's a he, so it's a male version of a debutante? What would we call him? What label could we put on him?
He's a young, innocent, Midwestern, Ivy League educated.
But he's naive.
Naive entry into the world of the torrid 20s.
Okay. So a young, naive intellectual.
Aspiring business, aspiring.
He's Harvard
he wants to attach. He wants to succeed in business and social life.
Okay. So an ambitious, young, and naive. What label are we going to put on him?
Midwestern, Ivy League educated.
Midwestern.
We're getting too much.
Right. We're getting too much. We got to back up. So, is he a farm boy?
No, I don't think. Just a small town guy.
Young, naive, small town guy. Naive is the flaw. Notice we got a hero.
Okay, we got
a
hero and a flaw.
Let's just go with that.
No, we got a hero and a flaw.
We got a hero and a flaw. What's the life changing event?
The encounter with the real corrupt world. Of the aspiring elite.
Okay, so and who's the opponent?
The opponents are the people the world that he aspires to crack into.
Okay, and does he have any allies himself?
It's complicated, but his main ally is himself. It turns out that that's the person who's going to rescue
him. So he learns to trust himself in the story.
He learns that he cannot trust others. It's a question about whether he has yet trust himself.
Okay. So that seems like part of the, and that's part of what we're going to get to, is we, the character arc is part of the, is the second plot line. Okay. But so we've got this, so opponent, ally, and the battle is him trying to make his way.
The battle. See, somebody who's listening to this who really knows Gatsby is going to call me and say, "Did you know what you're talking about?"
That's right.
But I think that the battle in Gatsby is the narrator's encounter with the world that he tries to enter, and that that's his opponent, that world, and that you hadn't asked for the resolution yet. Not in the first sentence.
It's okay. We don't need it. Don't need it. We need to know what the battle is. Not every story has a happy ending. And that's okay. Now, for popular fiction,
for romance, you've got to have
people like happy endings, mm-hmm. you know. What was it I heard? This is kind of a funny line. I use it. There's a, remember that old, the lawyer show? Oh, there's been a bunch of lawyer shows on television, but there was one where this guy lost the case and they had a writer, somebody watched the show regularly, write in and say, look, if I wanted to watch a lawyer ruse, I'd go watch my own lawyer. Right.
I love that.
So people are looking for fiction is often an escape.
Yeah.
It's the way we want the world to be, not necessarily the way it is.
Gatsby's different in the sense that it doesn't resolve all the conflicts for us, but it gets this guy over the hump in terms and destroys his illusions about the world that he aspired to enter, and the people that he aspired to associate with turn out to be disappointments. So that he winds up understanding, I think, that he is left with himself, that he must make his own life rather than riding on the backs of others.
The setting is part of the characterization in this story as well. It's important that it's at 1920s. So I would definitely say that is somewhere in the log line, because if it was set in outer space on the moon, it would be a different story than it when it's, you know, the 1920s it's New England.
It's in New York and in the Hamptons in Long Island.
Yeah. So, and that makes a difference.
Yeah. So let's try. Help me get it.
We've got a young, handsome, aspiring, naive guy who wants to work his way into this world of this social elite in the Hamptons in New York in the 1920s, finds himself having his ideals and his ideals and his
aspirations
and his, what is it when you, he's put these people up on a pedestal. Right? So they're going to come off that pedestal.
His ideals and idols.
His ideals and idols destroyed.
Come crashing down.
Right. So we've got a young, aspiring, naive businessman tries to work his way into the world of the 1920s elite in New York.
First sentence done.
First sentence.
We'll take a break. And those of you who think that I have not characterized Gatsby correctly, I don't want to hear from you. We're going to take a quick break. Linda Rohrbaugh and I are talking about her upcoming workshop at the North Carolina Writers Network's spring conference held in Greensboro this year on April 12th. We're learning a lot, but there will be much more to learn for aspiring writers and readers at this conference. Linda and I'll be right back, and we'll do some more working on our elevator pitch. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Linda Rohrbaugh, who is giving a workshop at the upcoming April 12th Spring Conference of the Writers Network. This will be held in Greensboro. She's giving a workshop for these great, wonderful literary writers who cannot talk in short sentences, and she's teaching them how to make a short, understandable, and persuasive pitch for their books. And she's trying to teach me. I've been pretending to be Scott Fitzgerald trying to do this, and it's been fun. Linda, I ought to talk a little bit. Let's break away from our development of the pitch. We'll come back to that.
Sure.
And talk about how you handled your workshop.
One of the things I do in the workshop is it's kind of a two-step process. Writers deal with a lot of fear, bottom line. Some of it's performance anxiety. Some of it's just, I don't know how to do, you know. Some of it's actually physical. Some of it's emotional. Some of it's intellectual.
They're like many of the rest of us.
Right.
They're not afraid, or we're not afraid, when we're writing by ourselves, even though it's difficult and we encounter problems. And there is some anxiety and tension. We're really not afraid of that. But when we're trying to sell something to somebody,
it raises a different world.
Every worry of rejection, of incapacity to do this. It's just tough. So I'm projecting, but that's what you've got
exactly
to overcome.
That's exactly what I'm doing. So part of the workshop is not just this exercise. I can teach you the formula in about 5 minutes. The problem is, getting you to execute the formula is a whole different animal. So I teach the people in the workshop about something called cognitive dissonance. I learned it from a psychologist that
I don't know what you're talking about. What is cognitive dissonance?
Cognitive dissonance is a function in your brain, and actually it's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. Cognitive dissonance, cognitive is about thinking, right? And dissonance is discord. It's a musical term as well. So what we're talking about, what happens in your head what's going to come up if you can listen to your own thoughts for a minute. When we start to work this way, is this is stupid, this is dumb, nobody's ever going to want to hear this, I don't know what I'm doing here. that's cognitive dissonance. And so I teach them about that. This is cognitive dissonance. This is what you can expect. I give them principles at the beginning of the workshop. And one of the principles is nothing can change when you're comfortable. And you're never going to be more uncomfortable than when you're in cognitive dissonance, period. So I teach them nothing can change when you're comfortable, how to recognize cognitive dissonance. Okay, here it is. Do you see it? That you're having these thoughts, you know. I can't believe anybody, you know, nobody's going to want to hear about this book. I don't know what I was thinking. I paid all this money. What I should run out of here, you know. I mean, they're having that, you know, this is going on in your head. And everybody laughs, but everybody knows
but it's
exactly
real.
What's going on. Okay, so. Then I do things like there's always a guy sitting in the back and he's got his arms folded. Right. Kind of like DJ is sitting there and he's got his arms folded now. And I say, you know, while I'm talking about what we're going to do, he folds them even up tighter.
He says, you're not going to make me get out there knocking on anybody's door.
And we all know what that means. And so I say to them, and this is so great because it works every time. I say to them, the first two workshops I did, I never told this story because I didn't know it was going to happen. At the end of the workshop, that guy came to me and said, I wish I had done what you asked. Okay, so I say, don't be him. Okay, you paid your money, you're here. It's going to cost you an hour and a half. What? Just open up to the experience and let's try this. And then I do things like, this is a little bit of a cheat, I tell them, get next to somebody who makes you uncomfortable. Get up.
Oh, what a great thing. Oh, I love this. What do you tell them? How do you persuade somebody to do that?
Well, I tell them about cognitive dissonance, and I tell them about you have to get out of your comfort zone, and I tell them about you have to be uncomfortable in order to change, right? And then I say, you can't make progress if you stay comfortable. Therefore, I want you to take a risk. And I have a bunch of bribes at the front of the room. If you go to my website, which is lindarorbaugh.com, there are these writer's clocks, and they're funny. People love them. They say write, revise, retreat, you know, toss, retrieve, writer's block, adult beverage, then write some more, revise, and then publish at the top. And it says writer's clock on it, and it has my website. And people love them. I have them up at the front, and I say, I'm going to give these away to people in this workshop, and I'm not going to tell you what you have to do to get one.
Oh, wow.
And I said, now, I've just created some cognitive dissonance in you.
What am I going to do?
On purpose. And I have somebody who's helping me, and their assignment is to watch for people getting out of their comfort zone. But I don't tell the group that. I just say,
how can you tell if somebody's getting out of their comfort zone?
Well, let's say, DJ, if you go sit next to the youngest man in the room who's got, And DJ's fairly conservative. You can't see him, but I can. He's got a plaid shirt on and a gray jacket. He's a fairly conservative, just as nice a guy, a wonderful smile. But if he went and sat next to a guy who was all pierced and...
Yeah, a motorcycle guy with a beard and a roughness, that would be... if I went to talk to that guy, I would be...
Right.
I would be out of my zone.
You'd be out of your zone.
And so that, but I would get a clock.
You'd get a clock. You'd get a clock. And so we wait till the end of the conference. We give, and sometimes I have a paparazzi playset, which is very exciting. The paparazzi playset has a whole bunch of action figures with cameras and microphones, and they're after you, right? So there's a dozen of them, and they're in different positions, and they're trying to photograph you. So people love the paparazzi play. I mean, between the clock and the paparazzi playset, they're going to get moving.
Oh, yeah. I think I would. Well, I want to break away. We're talking about writers and the upcoming writers' conference, and the workshop Linda's going to lead to help writers get out of their zone and talk about their books in terms that will work. I do think that the advice that you're giving them is good for every listener.
Right.
and it's really hard. And you think about going to a party or you're riding a bus and there are just a whole bunch of people in there that you know that you couldn't, you're not able to go break the ice. But what we learn from experience is that if we do overcome that, more than likely, maybe more than 50% of the time, not all the time, but most of the time, the conversation that you have with that person that you didn't even want to talk to leaves you with something you never would have gotten any other way.
That's exactly right. And I practice what I preach. So when I go to conferences, if they don't assign me, a lot of times they'll set me at a table and everybody first, right? And my name's on the table and people can come sit with me. So that's getting me out of my comfort zone. Mm-hmm. But I would prefer to go sit with the people that I know. But I don't do it. If I'm at a conference and they don't assign me to something, then I go look for a group of people that
you
I
look
don't
for the group. That would be a great way. Gosh, here I am taking all this away from you. I apologize to everybody for talking
right.
so much. But one part of me would always look around a room and try to find somebody I know to, and understandably, to go sit
That's
with.
That's the first thing I do too.
The part of me that is adventuresome would say, look, I can talk to that person anytime. Here's my opportunity to go meet somebody I never met, find out something I never knew. And I would just – I'm just lecturing myself to try that. You got me going.
I try to practice what I preach. Yeah. So if I'm – you know, when I have the opportunity to choose what's safe or to choose something that's a little bit risky, I go for the risky.
What great advice. Now, we do have to Linda and I are talking about her upcoming workshop at the North Carolina Writers Network's Spring Conference, April 12th in Greensboro. She's going to deliver a workshop there, and we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back, and I promise you I'm going to leave it all the way up to her to conclude and tell us what she will accomplish at that workshop. She and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I've been visiting with Linda Robo about her upcoming workshop on how to write, prepare, and deliver an elevator speech, all aimed at a writer who wants to sell or needs to sell others or to convince others that the hard work that the writer's done and come up with a book is worth reading, worth buying, worth publishing. Linda, I love talking to you, and I've been interrupting you like crazy, all of which is because you fascinate me. But you've got 6 minutes. So talk about what have we missed that might be useful
okay,
in terms
so
of developing that
Okay, so let me finish the
pitch.
Formula.
Yeah,
how's that?
Yeah.
So we've talked about the first line is hero, flaw, life-changing event, opponent, ally, battle. The second log line is my invention, and it came from listening to these New York Times authors. They talk about the character who arcs and the character arc. Now, if you don't, and this applies actually to nonfiction as well, and in the workshop I apply it, but nonfiction is much easier to do. So you give the first log line, then the second log line is how the character changed. Let's go back to Rocky. Rocky's easy.
Mm-hmm, okay.
The boxer with low self-esteem gets an opportunity to fight for the heavyweight title. First log line.
That's first line.
And all those elements are either implied or stated. Second log line is, he changes. And the way he changes, he learns to believe in himself first before he gets in the ring. So that's our second log line. The boxer learns to believe in, with the help of his girlfriend, learns to believe in himself before he steps into the ring. Second log line.
That's the second.
Yeah.
And you got one more?
The third log line is the theme. what is this story about? What's the big picture? And Rocky is all about how love transforms us, but love in a different kind of way. You know, that Chicago boxer kind of look, you know, it's very different. And how they bounce off each other before they figure out how to make this work. So it would be a theme about love. Love transforms us. Love changes us. So I would say those are the three log lines. Now, when you deliver the log lines, right, you say the first log line and you wait a second and you just let that uncomfortable silence. See, I've taught you about cognitive dissonance and I've taught you about change and I've taught you how to be okay with being uncomfortable. So you say your first log line, you meet somebody in an elevator and you say, "Hi, I'm Linda Rohrbaugh and I write suspense fiction. My book is..." And I tell writers, don't use your title. You don't need to. First of all, your publisher's going to change your title anyway. They almost always do. But the second thing is, you know, you need to get your first log line out there. So you say your first log line and then you wait. And you let them respond. And that is the hardest thing because everybody wants to do just blah, 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 you put it out there. And you want to wait because you want to have a relationship with this person.
You want them to speak to you or just to nod their head or what?
Sometimes they'll say, wow, or sometimes they'll say, oh, or sometimes, you know, they say, hi, I'm Linda Rohrbaugh. I write suspense fiction. I wrote a book where a pregnant computer programmer uncovers spiritual gifts from God that lead her across Middle Eastern terrorists or teaching teenage boys to be assassin. And DJ goes,
what?
Yeah. And I say, yeah, in the book, she learns not only does her unborn child need her, but he needs her husband too. And the theme of the book is men are important in the lives of children. Now, I just pitched you.
Well, yeah. You did it.
Yeah. And now you've got something to hang on to because there's this emotional component. The theme always has that emotional component, and so should the arc. And if you can be funny or charming in some way, then that's even more important. So those are the three elements I teach, and I teach about cognitive dissonance, and I've got rewards at the front of the room, and I've got people moving and talk, because I don't sit down with you and do this in the workshop. I rarely talk to anybody except at the front I'm presenting, but I give you a real short time, 3 or 4 minutes. Okay, we're going to divide in groups of three. I prefer odd numbers because then people don't, you know, they don't clab to each other, you know, kind of glob onto each other. And then it gives everybody a chance to talk. And sometimes if I tell you about my book a little bit, you can go, oh, well, that's – the hero is this then, or like we did with Gatsby. We're going to sit down and do that. And what's interesting is people do as much work in that 2, 3, 4 minute time as they do if I give them all week because it doesn't matter. The time isn't what's important. It's getting it out there and taking the risk. When you have a short time, you got to do it so you get it out there. Everybody leaves the workshop with a complete pitch. And here's what's interesting. At workshops, the North Carolina Writers Network is good about teaching people how to do this. But I go to other conferences where they make a point of bringing in a lot of editors and agents. I'd say 30 sometimes. So then I have people come up to me and say, this is some kind of trick. Editors and agents always say yes, right? They always say yes because I'm getting a yes every time I pitch. No, they don't. But they don't hear people this organized, that understand how to make this work. So, yeah. Now, just because you get a yes doesn't mean you'll sell the book.
But the door is open for you. You get the opportunity.
The door is open for you to put it in front of somebody. And that's the whole point. And then once you have that, then you go to, I have a friend, one of her biggest, Jody Thomas, one of her biggest signing locations is Walmart. Walmart loves her and Sam's Club. And they have her in to sign books. Well, people come in, they've never heard of her before. So she's got to pitch this book. She has a book where a man who was deaf, whose mother was killed by Indians, and I'm going to give you her pitch, okay? A man who was deaf, whose mother was killed by Indians, puts his name in a hat for a lottery for three women so he can get a wife, okay? So he writes old Western. But later he tries to get his name out of the hat because he realizes if he gets a wife, he's going to have to talk to her. Which is the funny part, right? So that's the character arc. And the theme of the book is we learn how to love, right?
Yeah.
And so he's used the sign language at different points in the book. So a reader will say, well, how does this work? And she'll say, well, you know, he signed I love you into her hand. She didn't understand it but because she doesn't know sign language before he could say it to her.
Well, listen. Great pitch. I buy that book, Carl. The door's open. And I want to go to Linda Rohrbaugh's workshop at the upcoming Writers Conference, April 12th in Greensboro. Thanks, Linda. This has been fun.
It's been a pleasure.
This is D.G. Martin who's talking. I'll be back here before you know it.